Well, just a reminder of where we left off. If you recall, Paul left out of Antioch here and traveled up here through Cilicia and into Galatia, and he was prevented from preaching in Asia and up in Bithynia. So he sort of skirts Asia and makes his way over here to Troas so that he can hop over at the Spirit's direction to Macedonia and spend some time in Philippi. And then last chapter, he goes to Thessalonica and Berea. And then toward the end of last half of the chapter, he makes his way to Athens. Of course, he has his great address there at Mars Hill. And finally, he makes his way at the beginning of this chapter into Corinth. And I was supposed to hit this in order to zoom in so you can actually see that stuff. And he makes his way from Athens over here to Corinth. And that's where we pick up this time again, still in the middle of Paul's second missionary journey. Well, he meets a couple of folks, Aquila and Priscilla, Eric and Corinth. Why had they come to Corinth? And then what did Paul have in common with them?
The Jews that were expelled from Rome by Claudius. Mm-hmm. And they had the same occupation, trade, which was tent makers.
Yeah, and here's another occasion in which Luke verifies for us the historicity of his account. Claudius had apparently been a fairly easy to get along with sort of emperor, but there is a Roman historian by the name of Suetonius who talked about Claudius expelling the Jews because they were continually rioting at the instigation of somebody by the name of Crestus. There are people who wonder whether that Crestus is Christ, and yet the Jews at the end of the book of Acts don't seem to know much about Christ, and so apparently this Crestus was not confused with Christ. It was somebody else. Maybe he was a Jew who was continually stirring up trouble, and so Claudius had finally had it with him and said, "Get out." This is a decree that he issued in AD 49. It looks like, if my notes are correct here. And as you say, yeah, they were both tent makers, and those looking at the custom of the Jews at this time, you might think it would be a bit of a strain. I mean, it'd be kind of like me being a tent maker, right? Last thing you want me to do for you is make a tent. I write computer programs all day. Well, Paul is he's an academic. He's a rabbi, basically. But here he is making tents. How do we square those two? Well, apparently it was the custom in those days for a man among the Jews to teach his son a trade. And usually the trade that you picked up was the trade that your father had, so that he could provide for himself, as Paul does here. As we don't see that mentioned explicitly so much here in the record of Acts, that he provides for himself the entire time that he's there. But as we look at the books of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, he makes clear that he does. In fact, he did provide for himself that entire time and never took a penny from them. So he is able, because of this training, to be able to provide for himself very well. In fact, most scholars of this period say that this was a pretty lucrative business. And as you can imagine, it keeps striking me as funny the number of things that we think of as new these days. The gig economy is new. Well, no, Paul had the perfect occupation to participate in the gig economy. He could make tents anywhere he wanted to. And there would always be somebody who needed a tent wherever he happened to travel. So it was a very good traveling occupation. Interesting little note, the goat's hair that they might make the tents from leather or from linen, but goat's hair was another common one, and they would weave it very tightly, and it did a very good job of keeping the water out. And that was actually named for the place that Paul was from, Cilicia. Or I'm sorry, it's the other way around. It was called Cilicium or Cilicium, and that's what Cilicia is named for, is this goat's material that they would make tents out of. Well, Stan, so we've mentioned a little something about Aquila and Priscilla. Were they Christians at this point before Paul met them, or clearly they become Christians later on? Did their conversion happen sometime afterward?
I don't know.
Okay.
Is that the answer you're looking for?
Moving on.
They, they are introduced by their occupation, not as disciples, as Luke mm-hmm. often does when he introduces a new character to the story. So maybe maybe it's because they weren't. Maybe it was because the occupation is more pertinent or germane to the story of his time in Corinth, as you mentioned. At the very least, I see him being of strong moral fiber.
Right.
Paul's willing to associate with them, be known associating with them there, so it would not hinder his work in Corinth. And of course, they become very influential for good, eventually returning to Rome and hosting a church in their home.
Yeah.
At some point. So.
Yeah. So no question what trajectory they end up on, whether they were necessarily Christians at that point. The case for the idea that they were Christians, Paul just seemed to pick right up with them immediately. I mean, it almost seems like a click that happens, not only because you share the same occupation, and obviously they were Jews as well, but they just seemed to get along swimmingly from the very beginning. What was that?
It mentions there in that same verse that Paul, or just after that he was spending the Sabbaths, of course, teaching and preaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't imagine Stephen going and staying with someone during these meetings he's been at and not at least discussing,
right? Yes,
the gospel.
Yep.
Daily.
Exactly. So then they get along from the beginning. And also there's no account of their conversion after this. Usually when we meet somebody who's not a Christian that becomes a Christian, we have an account, right? But we don't have that. So that would be the points in favor of the idea. Well, they were probably already Christians. But the case against as Stan mentioned, Luke doesn't call them disciples. So maybe they weren't. And we don't have any positive affirmation at this point of a church in Rome. It doesn't seem as if the gospel has made it there. Maybe it is. It has. And so they would have had an opportunity to hear the gospel already. But bottom line, we just don't know. We know that they become, as Stan said, they become very faithful, a very faithful couple. But at this point, we don't know exactly what their status is before they meet Paul. Well, Paul came to Corinth Sam, go ahead.
One thing I think that leans towards them possibly already being Christians is their ability to reason with Apollos and to teach him the full gospel so that he would know it. And it seems it's a relatively short time from, you know, this occasion when Paul joins himself till they go over to Ephesus and Apollos comes to Ephesus. So I don't know. That's just maybe one other point that kind of leans in that direction to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll tell you what, I will not get ahead of myself on the questions. Maybe I'll argue with you here in just a minute when we get to the relevant point. So I hear what you're saying. And again, I don't know that it's critical that we prove it one way or the other. I'll offer a point in contradiction, I guess, here in just a minute. So let's talk right quick about who joined Paul in Corinth. Now, if you recall, when he left Berea and went to Athens, he went by himself, or at least Silas and Timothy were not with him. They stayed behind in Macedonia. Well, they are finally able to rejoin him here in verse 5, or I'm sorry, in... looking at the wrong chapter here. In verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. So they were finally able to join him. And I wanted to highlight that because I think it'll have bearing on a little bit later question. And while we're here, before we get into talking about just how things go in Corinth, per the account here, just a reminder about what kind of a place Corinth was. They had a temple of Venus or Aphrodite at the city, and though that place was staffed by ritual harlots, and so that's how they would conduct worship there at that temple. In fact, to be a Corinthian, if somebody called you a Corinthian, that was not a compliment. It meant that you were a playboy, that you were a person of loose morals, and to Corinthianize was to spend your time with harlots. So Corinth already had a reputation even among the heathens for being a very worldly place, a very immoral place. But furthermore, if you look at where they're situated here, They're situated right here on this isthmus between the mainland of Greece here and the Peloponnesus, this big peninsula out here. And so you've got this one port city that's listed here, Cenchrea, on the east side. There was another port city over here, the name of which I'm going to butcher if I don't look at it exactly, Lechium, that was on this side. And so you can imagine if you're sailing with goods from this part of the Mediterranean over to Italy, let's say, you could sail all the way around the Peloponnesus here, but that could be fraught with danger. And so it actually ended up being safer to come over here, dock in Cenchrea, unload your stuff and then move across this relatively narrow isthmus over to Lechium and then complete your journey over this way. That was a safer and cheaper journey. In fact, I think I recall, I didn't stumble upon it when I was doing some reading this time, but I think I recall reading that they might even take the boats and drag them across the land. That's how narrow, I don't mean to say it's just, you know, 20 paces or something, but it, the fact that it actually ends up being safer and cheaper to drag a boat from one side of the isthmus to the other speaks volumes, I think, about the, how treacherous it could be, especially given certain times of year to make your way on, all the way around the Peloponnesus here. You know, kind of like, you know, we've got the Panama Canal, and it's a lot easier to go through the Panama Canal now that it's cut than it was to go all the way around the Horn of South America. So, as you can imagine, with port cities on either side there, Corinth enjoyed a lot of trade. They were a big place of industry, a very prosperous place. The Waldrons mention a Corinthian brass that was known throughout the Roman world and very highly prized. And so the Corinth was a famous city. You'll note, by the way, that the rich Corinthian leather was not highly prized. You know, the Ricardo Montalban ads for Chrysler way back when, that didn't exist. So they didn't have rich Corinthian leather. That was just a marketing thing from Chrysler. Anyway, so this is Corinth. This is the place he is, a very prosperous city, but also a very immoral city. And you might think that this is a place that where the gospel might not take off so well. But how did the people in Corinth, Michael, how did they receive the gospel? Paul had some successes. He also had some failures. Tell us a little bit about how things went.
So when he first went there, he went to he tried talking to the Jews, and it doesn't indicate that he got any kind of a foothold with the Jews. It seems that they rejected that pretty quickly.
By and large, for sure.
And so he left from there, and well, he told them, he said, "I'm going to talk to the Gentiles, and if y'all have no interest, I'm going to the Gentiles." And they were much more receptive. It does seem that he made inroads with, you know, at least Crispus being a Jew as the ruler of the synagogue, him and his household. But verse 8 specifically says, "And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized." So he had much better success with the Gentiles there than he did the Jews.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, we have one lone Jew that appears to, and I imagine it's probably more than that, but one prominent Jew that responded, but definitely by and large rejected by the Jews. We have this fellow Justus that he ended up staying. I think it's interesting that he leaves the synagogue and he goes right next door to stay with Justus. And so here, these Jews didn't want him around teaching. Okay, fine, I won't come into the synagogue. I'll just teach right next door. Let's see, as we move to question number 5 here, Joshua, the Lord gives Paul some special encouragement here. Tell us about that.
He spoke to him in a vision, telling him to speak boldly and to not be afraid, because God is with him and wouldn't allow anyone to harm him or attack him. And there were a lot of people in the city who were his people.
Yeah, and I know this wasn't part of the question exactly, but just off the top of your head, why might that be of special comfort to Paul when he says nobody's going to attack you to hurt you?
Because he'd been run out of so many cities with people trying to attack him and harm him. And overall, people have been pretty hostile against him. And having a lot of people around him would give him comfort to know that not only is God protecting him, but it's also good comfort that you have good people around you as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, stoned in Lystra, beaten and thrown in prison in Philippi. I can imagine this would be really, really special comfort to Paul. You know, throw in something else. When we look at the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, What is it that God tells all three of those fellows from the very beginning? I'm going to send you with the message, but how are they going to respond? Not going to listen. That's right. They're not going to listen. So God goes ahead and basically, I want you to do this job for me, but I'm dashing your hopes up front. Well, the fact that Jesus says, oh, I've got many people in this city, tells Paul not only is he not going to suffer physical harm, the kind of which he had to not only fear but had to endure in times past, but furthermore, his message is going to take root here. There's going to be some success. As Michael has already pointed out, how many hearing believed and were baptized. Let me point something out that occurred to me here. If you recall, take a look. Well, let's look at the language, number one, that Jesus uses here when he's talking to Paul. Joshua mentioned it. Looking at verse 10 here, he says, I have many people in this city. Now turn over to John 16. I'm sorry, not John 16. It's verse 16, but it's in John chapter 10. John chapter 10, verse 16. Now this is Jesus talking about being the good shepherd. And he says in verse 16, again, John chapter 10, verse 16, other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. So the Mormons want to take that verse and they want to construe it to mean, well, Jesus is talking about his disciples in the new world. And Calvinists look at that and they say, well, he's talking about the folks who will believe later but who are already predestined to be his disciples. I can actually agree with them if we agreed on the definition of predestined. But obviously, you know, I disagree on how they understand the idea of predestination. But when you take the New Testament as a whole, clearly, and especially the book of Acts here, clearly Jesus is saying not only Hebrews, not only Jews, but also Gentiles. Gentiles will be a part of this flock. I will be one shepherd over all of them. So that's very clear what he's saying. And he's saying that these have not yet believed. They're not yet my disciples, but they will be. They will become a part of this fold. Well, I think we have similar language here that Jesus uses back in Acts 18 when he says, I have many people in this city. It's not that these people were already converts, but rather they were people that Jesus knew would believe. They were people who would hear the gospel and they would respond favorably to it. And so I think that's what he means when he says, I have many people in this city. All right. So now moving on to question number six. Alan, when we look at how much time Paul was able to spend in the cities there in Macedonia, how does his time in Corinth compare to that?
Verse 11, it indicates he gets to stay in Corinth at least a year and 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and maybe more, depending on how you read the rest of the chapter. When it mentions many, he stayed many days, but mm-hmm. we know at least a year and a half, whereas he was lucky if he got to stay a week and a half in some of the other places. I mean, he would go in, he would teach, he would have a little success, and he would be run out of town.
Yeah.
Anywhere from days to weeks.
Yeah.
And here he has a chance to settle in. And it's interesting that comes right after your comments about, I have many people. You got work to do mm-hmm. in this city. And there's a lot of people that need to hear what you have to say. This is specific to Paul's mission from those that wording. Is that this is your job and you'll hand it over to somebody else later.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Good call there. Yeah. At least a year and 6 months. And the fact that verse 18 goes on after that to say a good while or many days. I mean, I don't know that we have a full 2 years here, but it sounds to me like it's a year and 6 months plus some amount of time. And so then Sam, to your point where you said that Aquila and Priscilla were able to persuade Apollos. Well, this was perhaps as much as 2 years in. And so again, not that settles the issue either way, and not that we have to settle it either way, but here you have two clearly very faithful Jews who became Christians if they were not beforehand. And it would not be outside of the realm of possibilities that I could see that they could persuade a man even like Apollos, even after having been Christians for a fairly short period of time. All right, then, so moving on to question number 7, Daniel. We have here, when we look at the letters of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, we have some evidence that perhaps Paul wrote them at this time while he was here in Corinth. So what kind of stuff did you find there as you looked there?
In 1st Thessalonians, Paul mentions, I think it's chapter 3, verse 6, that he wrote to them right after Timothy had come back to Corinth and was bringing news of them. So he wrote to them immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I think the time frame, this is Paul's first epistle, so around 51, 52 mm-hmm. AD. So the indication, you can cross-reference both books. You can kind of stop and take this almost at the point where Paul changes his base of headquarters, if you want to call it that, right? So moving to, I just lost the name, sorry.
Corinth?
Corinth, yes, sorry. After he turned it, he changed kind of his location where he was working. We just said it a moment ago, sorry.
Oh, the House of Justice, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So as he said, we don't see it as much in Acts. We get a little bit more added to the timeline when we look over in 1 Thessalonians, the last part of chapter 2 and into chapter 3. But so one of the reasons I mentioned in the questions that Timothy and Silas, of course, had just arrived there in verse 5 of chapter 18. When we look at what Paul has to say in 1 Thessalonians, again, we're not going to spend any time to speak of in the content of the book, but just attempting to place where they are in the timeline. If we look here in verse 6, but now that Timothy has come to us from you and brought us good news of your faith and love, that you always have good remembrance, and so on and so forth there. So it seems like Timothy arrived to wherever Paul was after Paul had to flee that area pretty, after being there, as Alan said, fairly short period of time. He was really concerned for how they were doing. And when Timothy arrived, he was able to send Timothy back with this first epistle. And then it doesn't sound like Timothy is there for very long before he brings back word of how they received the epistle, and Paul is able to write back in 2 Thessalonians. So it appears to be all in a fairly short period of time here that we have Paul's first epistle to the Thessalonians, well, first epistle that we have recorded, period, to the Thessalonians, and then a second one shortly on the heels thereof, because he deals with some misunderstandings that they apparently had from the first letter. All right. So moving to question number 8 here. We have this business, after he is there for about a year and a half, we have this business of being brought up in front of Gallio. So Andrew, tell us how this went. What kind of charges did the Jews bring against Paul before Gallio? And then how did Gallio end up taking all this and handling it?
Well, the Jews bring a charge that Paul's teaching men to worship God contrary to the law. Mm-hmm. And their entire plan just backfires on them really harshly. Gallio immediately responds with, what does this have to do with the law, with wrongdoing, with me, with bringing anyone? If this was a matter of wrongdoing, then I would hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It's very similar language to what we find with Pilate at the very beginning, with some of his conversations and statements that I see no fault. Well, what's going on? Well, you're bringing him because of envy. But here he's very dismissive, so much so that after he's not going to hear them, the Greeks take the new ruler of the synagogue and beat him right there in front of the judgment seat, and he takes no notice of it at all.
Yeah, there's a part of this that is very understandable. This fellow who is a secular ruler has no interest in getting into the details of the religion practiced by some of the locals here. I mean, can you imagine if we went to, I don't know, Mayor Marks or somebody like that and were complaining about, I don't know, how somebody was partaking the Lord's Supper. I don't know, something like that. I'm sure he'd say, yeah, this is not really my purview here. You guys work that out among yourselves. But this business about, them taking Sosthenes and and just beating him there in front of the judgment seat. It seems really strange because your Roman officials tended not to care for this kind of mob justice. They would usually put that kind of thing down. And so there are different ways people try to explain it. In fact, I mean, the King James, the New King James, they say the Greeks. But other translations just say they all. So there is some question as to whether it was the Greeks that actually got hold of Sosthenes and beat him. It may have been fellow Jews who were upset that Sosthenes bungled the attempt here somehow. He was the ringleader, but he wasn't able to get Paul. But even that doesn't seem quite right, because we don't think that Gallio would just sort of stand by and look away. So another explanation I've seen is that it wasn't so much that these Greeks amassed a mob outside and took this guy and beat him, but rather that in order to drive them from his presence, his own lictors, as they were called, got hold of Sosthenes and beat him because he was the ringleader. And Gallio certainly didn't take any notice of that, because he was trying to get them out of there anyway. It's interesting to note, again, on the historicity side, Gallio, you've heard of Seneca, for sure, the philosopher and the writer. Well, this was his older brother, Gallio. And again, Luke was thought to have been wrong for a long time, because they didn't think that Gallio was a proconsul. But 1909, Luke's proven right again. There's an inscription from the Emperor Claudius that was found near Delphi, and it calls Gallio not only his friend, but also the proconsul of Achaia. And of course, if you'll recall, this whole area here where that includes Corinth is Achaia, as Paul will talk about even in his epistle to the Corinthians. Another thing, Sosthenes, speaking of the Corinthians and the letters to the Corinthians, is this the same fellow that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians? No idea. It might have been. In other words, we had one ruler of the synagogue, Crispus, who converted. It's not outside the realm of possibilities that Sosthenes himself at a later date converted. But you know, we can't say that for sure. There's a part of me that roots for him, you know, that hopes it was, but we just don't know. All right, number 9, Doug. So what do we know about Paul's vow? It mentions down here, let me see, it mentions, after he had, no, I'm sorry, I'll find it here in just a minute. Here we go, verse 18. Paul, he remained a good while, and then he took leave of the brethren, sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. There's a certain amount question as to, is it Paul who took the vow, or was it Aquila who took the vow? We're not going to answer that question here, but what do we know about whether it was Aquila or Paul? What do we know about this vow that he took?
Definitively?
Yes, definitively.
Not much.
All right, there we go.
I found everything from, yes, it must have been a Nazarite vow, to no way it could be a Nazarite vow, and maybe it's a Nazarite vow.
Right,
so,
right.
Who knows?
Maybe it's some other vow. Yeah, exactly.
As far as Aquila versus Paul, I found in God's Word translation and the New English translation, they favor that. That's the way they put it, that it was Aquila.
Okay.
I like the NET translation for one reason. NET notes, because they explain why they came up with a given rendering.
Okay.
And most of the time they tell on themselves where they're wrong. I wasn't convinced that it was Aquila out of that.
Okay. Yeah. So bottom line, we just don't know a whole lot either. I will say that the force of the reading, Paul seems to be the subject. And so I dare say he's the one who's taking the vow. But what kind of vow it was, it's not necessary to construe this as a Nazarite vow. In fact, the fact that he's not in Jerusalem at the temple, shearing his hair and then burning it on the altar. That seems to argue against the idea that it was a Nazarite vow. There's another vow that Josephus mentions that where you would shave off your head, or your hair rather, shave off your head. That would be counterproductive. Shave off your hair at the beginning of the vow rather than at the end, like the Nazarite vow. Don't know. But the thing that I want us to notice here is that it was okay for Paul to enter into a vow, whether it was because he was keeping a Nazarite vow, you know, he's abiding by the law of Moses here, or some other vow. We can conclude, I think, from Paul's behavior that a Christian can enter with God's approval thoughtfully, not rashly, but thoughtfully into a vow if you see fit. Again, whether it's to abide by some custom or whatever, just so long as it is not inherently immoral in and of itself. Well, moving on, number 10 here. So Paul doesn't stay long in Ephesus. He makes his way from Corinth over here and sails over here to Ephesus. He doesn't stay long, or stay long rather, because he says he wants to make it to Jerusalem. Well, as I keep reading, I don't really ever find a place that it says he makes it to Jerusalem. Stephen, did he ever make it there?
Well, first of all, if you're reading from the New American Standard, it says, but taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again if God wills, he set sail from Ephesus. And every translation from the American Standard forward basically translates it that way, leaving out the, I must make it to a feast, with the exception of the New King James, which, of course, would be based on the King James. Mm-hmm. So, in the first place, when I read your question and then read the New American Standard, I thought, I don't know what you're talking about Jerusalem at all. But of course, you know.
Look, you're using an inferior.
But I knew I could not use the translation in front of me. And so, I went and looked, and of course the older translations do, include that phrase, as do older manuscripts. Yeah. But the key question is in verse 22, when he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church. It doesn't say Jerusalem, but Caesarea is the port city to get to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, the phrase going up is a critical phrase there. To go up in Jewish culture generally means to go up to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Jerusalem is always, no matter where you are, it's always up. Even if you're at a higher elevation, they would say, going up mm-hmm. to Jerusalem. And so it's not directional. Like we might say go up if you're going north.
Right.
But they mean up generally the mountain, but also up, you know, in a more maybe in a more symbolic way, mm-hmm. going up to Jerusalem. So almost certainly that's what it means in verse 22, that he landed at Caesarea. He went up mm-hmm. to Jerusalem. And in fact, the Net Bible would translate it that way. Would include Jerusalem and greeted the church. And then he goes back up to Antioch. So, yes, he did make it there. Whether or not he was making it for a feast or not depends on what translation you're using.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and it would be strange, you know, it says that he sets sail for Syria. It would be strange for him to come clear down here to Caesarea and then have to go by land.
Right,
all the way
Seleucia would be the place to land.
Yeah, this is where he'd want to sail to over here, Seleucia. Sorry, I should have had another slide that zooms in on Syria a little bit better and Judea. But anyway, yeah, so given where he landed and also what you're talking about there, this idea of going up, that Jerusalem is sort of implied there. And I brought this question out. You know, some of you, why are we spending time on this? It's easy for me. Maybe you guys pay better attention than I do, but it's easy for me to miss implications in the scripture. And we see this a lot in the scripture where if you'll stop and think about it, you're left with no other conclusion. But, if you're reading through hurriedly or not really paying attention, you can miss stuff like this. So I just wanted to point that out. I mean, okay, granted, not all the manuscripts say I'm heading for Jerusalem, but assuming that it does, it looks like maybe something got missed. Did he make it there or not? Well, yes, I think he did because of the reasons that Stephen mentioned there. All right, number 11, Nathan, Paul, so he goes back up to Antioch, but then it doesn't sound like he stays very long before he's ready to embark on the third. So here we have the end of the second missionary journey, and we barely able to blink before he's off on the third. And where does he go on the third? Or here at the very beginning of the third anyway.
So despite, I guess, what seems to be the consensus on maps, that he stops in Tarsus. It just tells us here that he goes to the region of Galatia and Phrygia.
Yeah.
And presumably Derbe would have been his first stop.
Yeah. Yeah. So all I'm doing here is getting us on the map. And yeah, you're right. Now, this is still a second journey slide. I don't have a third journey slide. But the idea seems to be if you're going this way, this is probably the route that you're going to take. But yeah, so he makes his way over here, and that's where we will pick him back up here in the next lesson, as he makes his way over toward Ephesus. And we're going to leave him there for a minute while we go back to Corinth for just a minute and pick back up with Aquila and Priscilla. So finally, Tony, you got 3 minutes, so right quick. Tell us about Apollos. Who was he, and how did Aquila and Priscilla help him out?
Apollos was a Jew, first of all. He's born in Egypt in Alexandria, which you can see there on that map, a major city of Egypt. He was an eloquent man. He was well taught, mighty in the scriptures, it says. So he knew the Old Testament, well instructed in the ways of the Lord. He was a fervent man, fervent teacher, diligent, zealous teacher. And he taught and spoke diligently the things of the Lord, but he did not have full knowledge. He knew only the baptism of John, it says. So he was speaking in the synagogue one day, and Aquila and Priscilla heard him and realized what he was teaching and that it was not the complete truth. So they pulled him aside and taught him the way, taught him the things that he was missing, the ways of the Lord, more diligent or more perfectly or more completely. And so what was his reaction? Well, it doesn't say so here, but we find out later that he was a fellow laborer. Apollos was a fellow laborer with Paul. And so it is necessarily implied that he did take the teaching well, and was baptized into the Lord at this time. Yeah. And, well, at some point. Yeah. And he became a diligent teacher with perfect knowledge. You know what I mean by perfect? Complete. Sure. Mm-hmm. Knowledge, able to teach the truth without leaving out those parts that he had no knowledge of before.
Yeah, and I think we can even conclude, even in this little portion of the account, that he became a Christian right here, because it says that he desired to cross to Achaia, and the brethren wrote. So you wouldn't think that the brethren in Corinth would write. I'm sorry, in Ephesus rather, would write and command him unless he were a Christian. All right, I will shut up. Thank you so much for your attention and comments, and I hope to see you all on Sunday.